Okay. We are up to number 8. I believe we finished number 7, which was the discussion of the Nevuah of Moshe and the unique status of the Nevuah of Moshe, the role of Moshe, and essentially the thesis that we suggested. Oh, wait, there was one piece we didn't get to. Now I remember there was a piece we were going to get to was the Rambam Zigeret Teman. I had given you the source for it. All right, doesn't matter. We'll talk it out. Essentially, the thesis that the Rambam has forward is that the Nevuah of Moshe is unique. It has its own status. And it's different from the definition of a Navi. In other words, a regular Navi has, on the one hand, is a description of a certain level of religiosity and spirituality. A person who has a certain closeness with God. And can even, if we take it one step further, have a message that God gives him to convey to the people. But it's an ongoing dynamic. You can have Nevi'im at any time. You can have Nevi'im at any generation, assuming that you have a certain mechanism and structure of the nation in place for a Navi. There's a Gemara that says that you can't have a Navi outside of the land of Israel, and you have to have the Beit HaMikdash functioning, but essentially the mechanism is there. But it's not a unique role to a unique time, to a unique place, or to a unique purpose. Whereas Moshe, as a Navi, is unique on multiple levels. Number one, his quality of prophecy is different. He is, and we talked about, Rambam talked at length about the differences in those, what those qualitative differences are. And the purpose of his prophecy is different. The purpose of his prophecy was to convey Torah. You only need to convey Torah once. And so Moshe enters into a unique relationship with God that has a unique purpose to a unique time. And therefore the Torah can attest to the fact that never again will there be a prophet like Moshe, not only because nobody else can reach that level of spirituality, because in theory anybody could, but specifically because the Torah, God will never need to set in place another Matan Torah, another experience of giving the Torah, another prophet to convey the Torah. And Moshe therefore becomes a unique blip in history. That's essentially where we left off. Correct? There it is, right here.
Thank you.
So we are up to number 8. So what I've done here is that you have the two sides of this page. I've given you is the text of the Perish HaMishnayis, which is the text of the Rambam's actual 13 principles. And again, a passage from the Rambam's Yad HaChazak, a passage from his halachic work. And then we'll see in the end where a summary. Hayisod HaShmini. The 8th principle. The translation I actually took from a website, so I can't really vouch for the translation as much. I don't know. I haven't actually read through it. I just pulled it off a website, so easy. Hayesod HaShmini Hayot HaTorah Min HaShemayim. The 8th principle is that the Torah is from heaven, meaning is divine. This is the flip side of principle 7. Principle 7 is that Moshe's Nevuah is unique. The substance of Moshe's Nevuah is the Torah, and that's principle number 8, that Moshe is the one who gave us the Torah, and the Torah therefore comes from God. V'hu shenamin ki kol ha-Torah hazot ha-nituna al yedei Moshe Rabbeinu alav ha-shalom. This entire Torah that we have given to us by Moshe, shehi kula mipi agvura, that it in its entirety is of divine origin. Kloma, shehigia elav kula me'et Hashem itbarach, that it completely was given to us by God, ve'inyan shenikra al derech ha-she'ela dibur, in a manner which was we would call speaking. We would call speaking because God doesn't speak and man doesn't hear in the classical sense of prophecy. But in some way, God spoke to Moshe. We call it Dibor. Hayedaber Hashem Moshe. In some way, Moshe heard. Ve'en yedu ehech higia. We don't necessarily know how this kind of speech took place because we don't experience it. Ela haya Moshe alav shalom shehigia lo. It certainly came to Moshe. Bechihu aya kamo sofer shekorin lo v'hu kotev kol me'orot hayamim hasfurim v'hamitzvot. Moshe was like a scribe. You call over and you tell him like a secretary. Write this, write that. V'lefichach nikra mechokek. And that's why Moshe is called a mechokek. Mechokek means, mechokek is an interesting word. It comes from a number of different sources. It has a number of different uses. It literally means to carve. But that's because ancient writing was carved. So it's a writer. We call a writer a scribe. So he was a scribe, a mechokek. Mechokek can also be a lawgiver, because it comes from the word chok. But actually, I think that's a borrowed term. I think the word chok actually comes from the fact that lechakek is to carve out. So you carved laws onto tablets. Now, what essentially the Rambam is saying is that this eighth principle is the notion that the Torah that we have is in fact the Nevuah of Moshe. I need these two principles in tandem. Just the notion that Moshe's Nevuah is unique and immutable by itself is only half the picture. I still have to connect that to the actual Torah and say that Torah is, by Masoret and tradition has come down to us, is the Torah that was given to us by the Nevuah of Moshe. Once I make that connection, then the Torah becomes binding, immutable, eternal. It takes on the substantive the qualitative status of the Nevuah of Moshe, which we spoke about in Principle 7. But I need that next step, which is to say that the entire Torah we have is in fact the Torah that came from Moshe. Ve'en efresh ben, quote, ubnei cham kush u'mitzrayim v'shem ishto ma'at ba'el v'timna v'intimna ita pilegesh. There is no qualitative difference between verses such as Preshit Perek Yud, the children of Cham were Cush and Mitzrayim, or in the name of his wife was Mahat Ba'el, or Timna was his concubine. Lineage, Sefer Breshit, go back to the beginning of Sefer Breshit, and there's all kinds of psukim about the lineage of the ancient families. Those psukim are of equal sanctity and of equal status to the pasuk Anochi Hashem Elokecha, or Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. It all comes from God. It's all part of the Torah. Ki akol mipi ha'gvura, v'akol terat Hashem tamima, tahara u'kdusha emet. It's all part of the Torah. It's all part of the sanctity, the purity, and the truthfulness of the Torah as we have. V'ze she'omer she'kmo eile ha'psukim v'hasfarim Moshe sifra mida'ato. Anybody who says that these verses, or these sipurim, these stories, Moshe sifra mida'ato, Moshe told them on his own, anybody who accepts the notion or suggests, put forward the thesis that these psukim or these stories or aspects of the Torah were invented by Moshe, Hinehu etzel chachamenu unevienu kofer umegale panim yoter mikol hakofrim. Such person is in the category and the mindset of our sages considered a heretic. Lefi shechashav sheyesh b'Torah lev uklipa. Because he believes and he puts forward the notion that there is a heart, meaning an important part of the Torah, and a shell, meaning a lesser important part of the Torah. To borrow the terminology from the biblical critics, if the Levitical book is more important than Deuteronomy, then where have we come to? You know, then I'll start picking and choosing and start slicing and dicing this mitzvah and that mitzvah, and you can unravel the tapestry of Judaism very quickly. One who would suggest that these stories or these events are of no significance, and that they were invented by Moshe, or that they were made up by the rabbis of a time, which is even worse. That's what our sages mean in the Gemara in Sanhedrin Ein Torah min haShemayim. Somebody who says that Torah doesn't come from heaven. Ein Torah min haShemayim. Somebody who denies the divine origin of the Torah. Amuch haChamim zal hu haMa'amin shekol haTorah mipi haGvurah chutz min haPasuk ze shelo amar Kadosh Baruch Hu al Moshe mipi atzmo. A person who says Ein Torah min haShemayim, says the Gemara, is a person who says that the entire Torah comes from God except for one verse. That is sufficient, or even one letter. That is sufficient to violate this principle. Zeo ki dvar Hashem biza, Hashem barach viter mimamar kofrim. This is somebody who despises the words of Torah. Ela kol dibur v'dibur min haTorah. Every single statement in the Torah comes from God. Yesh behen chachamot uplaim. There are in every phrase and in every word of the Torah great wisdoms and great understandings and in depths and wonders. Lemi shemevinota, for those who can understand them. Velo sag tachlit chochmatam, we cannot possibly comprehend all of their wisdom. Arucha me'eretz midah, rochava min hayam, the wisdom of the Torah, to borrow a phrase from Mishlei, is longer than the earth and broader than the sea. It's possible from Yov actually. Ve'ein le'ish ela lehalech be'ikvot David Mashiach Elokei Yaakov sheitpalel gal einai ve'abita niflot mitoratecha. We are simply to do that which David HaMelech said when he said, God should open my eyes that I may behold the wondrous things in the Torah, even phrases we don't understand. So if you have a pasuk at the beginning of the Torah that seems to talk about the grandchildren of Noach and who's the pilegish of whom and who's the lineage of whom, don't say that these are insignificant parts of the Torah and that they're not really part of the God didn't write them. No, every God wrote everything, and we simply do not understand everything yet. So far, what he has said is fairly straightforward, and I don't think is a surprise to any of us that every part of the Torah comes from God, and that's the foundational principle of Judaism, of Torah min haShemayim, is this idea that the Torah is a divine book. It's not man-made, it's not rabbinically made, and even to the point where we could say it's not even made by Moshe Rabbeinu, this is clearly given by God. Moshe is simply the conduit. As we say every time we do Hagbah, V'zot HaTorah, Asher Sam Moshe Lifnei B'nei Yisrael, Api Hashem B'yad Moshe. This Torah that Moshe gave to B'nei Yisrael was by dint of God's command. And I don't need to belabor the point. I think it's clearly obvious to all of us that that is a foundational principle of Judaism. What the Rambam does in the next paragraph, however, is vitally important. And he says, "Ukamochen perush haTorah haMikubal." This principle applies as well to the traditional interpretation of the Torah. That which is mikubal, handed down from generation to generation, as a perush, as an interpretation of the Torah. Also, gamken mipi haGvura is also of divine origin. What is he referring to? The Oral Torah. This is where he links everything that we've said up until now about the written Torah to the Oral Torah as well. And the Oral Torah is, in a certain sense, even more important for us because you can't understand the written Torah without it. And the practical application of Torah into the mitzvot of our daily lives operates through the conduit of the Oral Torah. So you cannot separate them. If you separate them, you unravel the tapestry that everything is built upon. וזה שאנו עושים היום מתבנית הסוכה ועלולה ושופר וציצית ותפילין וזולתם, the fact that we today do the mitzvot of sukkah, lulav, shofar, tzitzis, tefillin, הוא בעצמו התבנית אשר אמר השם יתברך למשה, והוא אמר לנו, והוא נאמן בשלוחותו. That's because these forms have been given to Moshe orally, and we have received them from Moshe in an accurate transmission. In other words, what the Rambam is alluding to here is a very interesting observation. It's one of the classic proofs that there had to exist an oral Torah. One of the classic proofs, logical proofs, to the existence of an oral tradition that went side by side with the written Torah. Is that the Torah lists many mitzvot, and the Rambam lists them here, which, if you were to open up the text of the Chumash, you would look at them and you would say, if you knew nothing, they would be meaningless. The classic example is tefillin. The Torah requires you to wear tefillin. It calls them totafot b'neinecha. Bind these words to your hand. Tie them as totafot between your eyes. What do they look like? What are they made out of? Which words are included in them? How do you bind them? The Torah's description of mitzvah tefillin is vague at best. And it's a mitzvah that appears in the Chumash 4 times. And every time it appears in exactly the same way. Minor variations, but essentially, there shall be signs upon your hands and totafot, whatever totafot means, between your eyes. We don't even know what the word totafot means. Totefet. It's not a Hebrew word. So here we have a mitzvah. The single most important word in this mitzvah is ambiguous and not of Hebrew origin, so we don't even know its meaning. And yet, in every community around the globe that is where Jews live and wear tefillin look, for the most part, identical. There's no dispute anywhere in Jewish tradition, in Jewish communities, or in the Gemara as to what tefillin look like. You don't even have, you can have various embellishments in terms of the casing for them. But every pair of tefillin around the globe, in every community, as isolated as they may have been, from the Ammonites to the Ashkenaz, essentially look the same way. Minor variations in terms of the parshiyot and which sequence to put in. But the Torah doesn't define what they are. There's no way to look at the Torah Shebichtav and know how to wear tefillin. One of the great debates in the Second Temple period was the debate with the Tzdukim and Baitusim. This is mentioned in the Mishnah in Pekei Avot. The Sadducees, essentially the Sadducees for all intents and purposes, they're an easier group to identify. And they were a group that ostensibly denied the existence of the oral Torah. That was their argument, that there is no oral Torah, that the only thing that existed was the written Torah, and therefore their interpretation of the mitzvot is based purely on the written Torah. In reality, it's a farce, because even the Tzdukim performed many mitzvot on the basis of the oral Torah. They all wore tefillin. And the major debates between the Tzdukim and the Pharisees in the time of the Second Temple revolved around nuances. Revolved around, for example, the question of the existence of the world to come, the existence of Olam Haba, was the first major break between the Tzdukim and the Baitus and Chazal. Whereas the Tzdukim denied the existence of any kind of afterlife, because they believe only in the written Torah, and in the written Torah there's no mention of an Olam Haba. But they all wore tefillin. And you can't tell me that the tefillin is based on the mitzvah of Torah Shebichtav without any kind of oral tradition associated with it. Sukkah. Lulav. Lulav is a classic. And they all took a lulav and esrog in the Second Temple period, everyone, and they all had the same minim. All the Torah says about the Arba minim is that you'll take the branch of a palm tree, and you'll take the myrtle branch, and you'll take a willow branch, and you'll take the fruit of a beautiful tree. Pri Eitz Hadar. Which fruit? Of which beautiful tree? Somebody wants to walk into shul with a lulav, hadas, arava, and kiwi. Allowed? If all you follow is the written Torah, all the written Torah says is the fruit of a beautiful tree. A kiwi is a beautiful fruit. Why can't I take a kiwi? So you tell me it has to be indigenous to the land of Israel, because the Torah was given with the land of Israel. Fine. So I'll take an olulav, hadas, arava, and pomegranate. It's a beautiful fruit. One of the Arba Minim. One of the Shivas Aminim for Eretz Yisrael. What stops me from taking a pomegranate on Sukkot instead of that? It has to be an esrog. An esrog is a very strange fruit. It's called a citron. A very strange fruit. It's not even one of the Shivas Amin. Never in the annals of Jewish history has anybody ever suggested using any kind of fruit other than an etrog. Why not? In other words, what I'm suggesting is that the first basic core concept of an oral Torah is not the Mishnah, the Talmud, the Shulchan Aruch. Far more elemental than that. The first core piece of a notion of an oral Torah is the basic understanding of every mitzvah, which required an interpretation. Lulav, sukkah. Kashrus. All the laws of kashrus. Kashrus becomes more controversial because there were great debates over kashrus. But there were no debates over esrog, and there were no debates over what a lulav looks like and what an esrog looks like. And these were clearly ambiguous in the Torah. The Torah says, sit in sukkahs, sit in booths for 7 days. What does a sukkah look like? There's no mention anywhere of what a sukkah looks like. Oblong shofar. So these are the mitzvot that the Rambam identifies as examples, tzitzis, tefillin, shofar, lulav, sukkah, tzulatamu ba'atzmot, tavnit asher Hashem yitbarach amal Moshe, v'hu amar lanu, v'hu neman b'shlichuto, these types of mitzvot and what they look like were clearly given to Moshe, transmitted through Bnei Yisrael. Bnei Yisrael transmitted them from generation to generation. And therefore, we are bound not only to the written Torah, but to the authenticity of the oral Torah as well. One of the examples that you find in the discussion about the oral Torah, one of the interesting examples that you find in the Gemara is the notion that Torah Shebaal Peh included the vocalization of the words in the Torah. What do I mean? And this is truly unique to Hebrew. I think I'm safe to say, maybe Arabic too, I don't know Arabic, I don't know other Semitic languages, but I think I'm safe to say certainly the languages we are familiar with today, Hebrew is the only, if not one of the... One of the only, if not the only, language which the vowels are not written down. Where the language is written with only the consonants and the vowels are oral. Am I right? Are there any other languages of such?
Arabic.
Arabic is like that. Semitic, must be Semitic languages.
Very, very close. They have the same thing.
The vowels are not written. You have to know.
Well,
them.
Or they're implied in certain, like they have the equivalent of vav, which is
right.
They have aleph as well. Right.
But essentially, their vowels are oral
right.
Interpretation. So, and I think it's true for Semitic languages. But when you're dealing with a law text like the Torah, and you write it in a text in which there are no vowels, you end up with some very interesting possibilities. And without an oral Torah to interpret how to read the text, just the basic core how to read, you could easily misread and therefore misinterpret. And there are places, in most places, the language is pretty straightforward, meaning that if you look at a certain word in Hebrew, even if you don't know how to read without dots, as they say. You can probably figure out most words just by recognizing the consonants. Somebody sent me on the internet a couple of months ago a paragraph written without any vowels in English.
You're in trouble.
And you could read it.
Right?
You could read it. It was very interesting. You had to kind of fumble for it a little bit, but you could get through it. But in Hebrew, you end up with some very interesting issues. I'll give you an example. Pardon me for being so far away.
Mm-hmm.
These are examples that the Gemara gives. So they're classic. You mentioned kashrus, right? First of all, read that word.
Bite.
If I were to put it on, I would assume it's bite. Now, it could be something else, depending on its use. It could be bite. It could be bite. It could be
bait.
Bait. If it's the house of somebody else. If I'm talking about somebody's house, I would talk about beito, his house. So I can change the vowels according to its context. That's the power of Hebrew. Right? Let's try this. Shin bet ayin.
Sheva.
Sheva. Sheva, right? Could it be read some other way?
Saba.
Sava. Which means to be satiated.
Right.
Could it be read any other way?
Shavua.
How about Shavua? Which means?
Week.
A week. Which actually comes from the same root as
Sheva.
Sheva.
Yes.
So I can take the same three-letter consonant, change the vowels, because they come from the same root, and end up with a different word. Now, let's try this one.
Shivim.
Shivim. Which means?
70.
Seven. 70.
Seven.
Right?
Seven.
Or?
Shvayim.
Which means?
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
There's a big difference between 70 days and 2 weeks. This example comes right out of this week's parsha, because the pasuk in this week's parsha says, with regards to childbirth, that after a woman gives birth, she goes through a period of impurity for immediately following the childbirth, and then a period of purity, even if she is still bleeding. It's a concept of dam tohar in the Torah, which doesn't apply today practically, but there is such a concept of the halacha, and therefore the Torah says, v'tam'a. She's tame for a certain period of time, and she's tahar for a certain period of time. The word the Torah uses is this one. How long is she tame for? 70 days or 2 weeks? Makes a big difference. Right? The halacha is v'tama, the way we read it is v'tama shivu'ayim. 2 weeks, but it makes a difference. Here's another one. What word is that?
Halav.
Halav, which means
milk.
Milk.
Could be chalav.
What if I wrote it that way?
Chalav is a kind of fat.
Chalav is a kind of fat that's forbidden to eat. Okay. The difference between halav and chalav, subtle. No big deal, right? Milk is milk. Chalav is prohibited. That's the only difference. One is prohibited and one is permissible.
That's good scheme up.
Now try this one.
Lotivashel
gedi
v'chalav
imo. You shall not cook a kid in its mother's milk, which is the source of all the halachot pertaining to meat and milk, which you mentioned before. All of the issues related to fleishos milchiks, not cooking together, not eating together, etc., are all based on this pasuk. But there's no vowels in the Torah. This is the time I probably missed the most important issue. The written Torah has no vowels. The written Torah is consonants only. We supply the vowels. So what would happen if I argued that this word was chalev imo? Don't cook a kid in its mother's fat, which is the forbidden fats of an animal that have to be removed before an animal can be rendered kosher. And cooking in fat is not an uncommon practice. We do it all the time. We call it
frying.
It's much more logical. Who cooks an animal in milk? Frying an animal makes a lot of sense. Says the Torah, don't cook the kid, the goat, in... When you're frying it, don't make sure you're not doing so in a chela, which is forbidden to eat. Well, if that's the case, then I have no source for the prohibition of milk and meat, in which case we can take the entire categorical group of laws of kashrut that deal with milk and meat, throw it out the window because it doesn't exist.
Milk sheep doesn't exist anymore. Fat sheep.
So you're never going to have that. We're not going to have a fat sheep.
Fat sheep. So you understand that this basic concept of the oral Torah, before you even get into derivations of laws and disputes about laws and the Mishnah and Gemara, before you even get there, the most core basic element of Torah Shebaal Peh is how to read the text of the Torah. Because the words, the consonants themselves are ambiguous. Without the vowels to accompany them, the text is meaningless, and the vowels are oral. There's no written vowels in the Torah.
But there must have been an even more fundamental question. Because when God gave when Moshe wrote the Torah, who else knew the characters? He wrote them in...
Well, there's a dispute whether he wrote them in the block script that we use,
right,
or an older Hebrew script,
right,
called Ivrit. Assuming he wrote them in an older ancient Hebrew,
right,
they all wrote and spoke ancient Hebrew.
So they knew those...
Yeah, it was the language of... Remember that all Semitic languages essentially come from the same source.
Right.
So they all spoke various dialects of an ancient Semitic language, whether it was Arabic or Hebrew or Aramaic. They're all essentially sourced in the same kind of family of languages. I have a theory as to why Hebrew was, or Semitic languages as a whole, and it's interesting that you said that Arabic is the same way, because it made sense to me that Arabic was the same way. Theory as to why these languages have an oral vowel system and not a written vowel system. And it's the same theory, it's the same answer to the question of why these languages are all right to left and every other language in the universe is left to right. And the Semitic languages are all right to left. Hebrew, Arabic, Aramaic, Ugaritic, that whole family of languages are all right to left. Whereas all Latin languages are left to right. This puzzled me for many, many years. So I found an answer from a professor of religious studies.
The explanation that I heard, but I'm not even sure that is the correct explanation, is you have to finish writing the word in Hebrew before you can actually pronounce it or read it. Whereas if you you write a Latin character word, you can read it progressively. You don't need to get to the end to start reading.
I'm not sure that would sound...
Well,
I don't know if that sounds scientific enough to satisfy my... maybe.
If you have the vowels, you'd be able to start sounding out the word, but if you
So why don't we have the vowels? Why? In other words, it's the same question, just from a different angle. Right? So how come these Semitic languages all had a oral system of vowels rather than a written system of vowels? Latin languages, the vowels are written into the language. They're written as consonants.
Right? Silly answer?
Yeah.
They were left-handed and they didn't want to smear like I do all the time.
Well, everybody in Semitic world is left-handed.
Yeah, I said it was a silly answer, but it would work very nicely for left-handed people.
It worked, but you're on the right track. You're definitely on the right track. Clearly,
They wrote in another direction because they were using the other hand. Right, that's clear. You write in English, when you write left, you have to write using the hand opposite the direction that you're writing. Because if not, have you ever seen the way left-handed people write English?
I don't do that, but you smear.
You smear. You go like this. You end up, or you turn the paper sideways. Because it's very hard to write, especially if you're using an ink. It's very hard to write left to right with your left hand. You have to stay ahead of your text.
Mm-hmm.
Agree? That's assuming, right? Are you left-handed?
I'm left-handed.
So you understand this.
Yeah, but I don't do that.
Right.
But yeah, it is, it's
very hard, especially if you're writing with wet ink.
Oh, yeah. I used to get in big trouble when you had to use cartridge pens. It would smear all over my hand, messy paper.
I'm sorry. You see, people who are right-handed don't even understand the problem.
We do if you put vowels in.
Right? Now, all languages that are sourced in writing are left to right. Semitic languages are the oldest languages on the planet. And they are older than the medium of writing. They are born at a time when the only form of writing was chiseled. Now, when you chisel with your right hand, but you hold the pen in your left, and you chisel. You can't chisel left to right, so you chisel right to left. This I heard from a professor of religious studies at the University of Calgary. His name is Eliezer Siegel. He was the Gabbai in my shul in Toronto, in Calgary, and it was the most simple. It was the simplest observation. It was like it opened a world of insight.
Oh, you can't chisel left to right.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. But therefore
it's much harder. Remember, you're right-handed. The assumption is that the language is developed by the majority, which is most people are right-handed. So when you're chiseling, you try chiseling right to left. You're backwards. Think about it.
Mm-hmm. So whereas were they chiseling into stone or into clay tablets or something?
Anything.
It doesn't matter.
There was no writing. Writing is a much later invention. So you're chiseling. When you're chiseling, it's much easier to chisel right to left.
So now why with the vowels, with the chiseling?
Because it's much harder to chisel vowels. Think about it. Vowels are very hard to chisel. If you put in a tiny dot, you chop away the whole thing.
Plus, we're thinking like...
Well, but the vowel could be just like another character.
It could be, right? But in the Semitic languages, they were not.
They were not.
But my question wasn't why they're dots. My question is why the dots aren't in the... Why the dots remained oral.
Right.
Because the tradition of writing was that you chisel the letters, the vowels you left out, because you can't chisel the vowels.
I had a professor who had this whole, studied like how people think differently based on the medium. And certainly they were an oral culture, so they had a capacity to remember what was said orally in a way we can't even fathom.
That's true.
So probably the writing was more like just kind of a memory tool, like here's the basic letters, you'll remember the rest, rather than what we need is we have an idea of seeing something exact, and if it's not written exact, we have a different mindset in terms of written, how it should be, and what's truth, and where I could see how if you could remember it all, and this is more just
the whole cultural context.
Yeah.
That's shorthand.
Right. And that's very interesting. Come back to me with that observation after our next class, because our next class is going to deal with the question of which came first, the written Torah or the oral Torah. And the classic understanding is that the written Torah was given and then the oral Torah was an interpretation of it. And what I'm going to suggest to you is actually that the process was reversed. That the oral Torah came first. And the written Torah was a kind of shorthand to it. Which is very interesting to your connection to your observation. But clearly the notion of the way the Torah was written, specifically without written vowels, you'd have to have some kind of oral tradition just at the bare minimum to read it, because otherwise it's ambiguous. And whole sections of halacha are built out of the ambiguity or the resolution of the ambiguity of certain words.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where the notion that the Torah was
even if you accept that the Torah was written by God, but the oral Torah is certainly written, made up by the rabbis, and there's all, the Rambam goes, spends a great deal of time trying to argue against, but at the very core of it, it doesn't make, it's illogical, because there's no way that you could have a written text without an associated oral tradition. How large that oral tradition is open to debate. But the existence of that oral tradition is indisputable. And that's where the Rambam leaves off. Okay, the next piece that I wanted to do, which is the Rambam's introduction to the Yad HaChazakah, is really one of the most famous pieces of the Rambam, in which he traces the oral Torah from its oral source to its written form. How does the oral Torah come to us in a written form? For us, the laws of the oral Torah and the substance of the oral Torah is known to us through texts, the Mishnah, the Gemara. So if it's oral, how is it that we have it written down? Clearly, at some point or another, most of those traditions had to be committed to writing, and the question of why and when is a matter of great dispute. The next passage in the Rambam deals with exactly that question. I'm going to actually suggest that we don't do it tonight because we have pretty much run out of time. I apologize that we started late, but...
Has anyone ever, what you taught us tonight, has anybody ever written about that?
I don't know. I mean, about which part?
All of it, like the chiseling. And
about the right to left, I'm sure there are articles written. It's not my field of academia, but it's...
That I've heard before.
Yeah, the reason is that it's chiseled instead
I've heard before.
I'm still having trouble seeing why you couldn't chisel it that way.
It's much harder.
Because you're saying your right hand is your right hand.
Not if you're right-handed. Your right hand.
It's a lead assist pattern. So you've got your lead hand is your strong hand, and you assist with your weak hand. Of course, I just did it.
No, the other way around.
You're lefty.
You're lefty, right?
Because I can't. If I wanted to chisel, when I pretend to play the violin, I do it backwards. I just can't.
Right.
I'm just so slow left-handed.
Right. But if you think about it, when you're chiseling, when you're holding against the piece of stone, you're just holding it steady. All the work is being done by the hammer that's chiseling.
Right.
Okay. Your hand is in the way. Your hand has to be here to be able to do that. You're chiseling on your right side. You can't reach over and chisel accurately from your left side.
But at some point, you're going to be on either side of the tablet.
You're going like this.
All the time.
We'll go home and do it.
I'll go home and do it, Get the play out.
Try it. Right. It's much easier. Just think about it not in terms of whether it's doable from the other side, but what's more logical. Remember that there's no precedent. So what's the most intuitive style there? Intuitively, you pick up the hammer and you go like this. How do you hammer a nail into a wall? Do you put the nail on your left side and hammer like this, or do you put the nail on the right side and hammer like this?
You can do both, but the question is which way would you move?
No, but intuitively, where are you starting? You're not going to start here and go there.
If you had ten nails in a row...
Right, but if you're starting on the right, you're going to go to the left. You're not going
to
start going
right to left. Right? If you're righty, you'd have to work from right to left because you have to...
Which hand are you hammering?
You cannot...
I'm hammering with this hand. I'm a righty. And holding my nail with the left hand,
you have to hit
my hand is in the way of the next hand.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you're going to go from left to right, it's much easier to keep the hammer perpendicular to the chisel. If I'm going this way, I can't get that perpendicular strike. I'm going to hit it and
it's
angle
it. It's easier to start on the right.
And then at that point, you go to in front of you. I mean, it's just intuitive. I can't, whether there's academic,
if you don't hit the chisel perpendicularly, the chisel slides and you damage the work. So it's very important to hit it perpendicularly. So if I'm hitting this way, I can do it more comfortably than if I'm trying to hit this way. Because if I've got to go way over here and try to hit this way all the time, I'll always hit skew. It's not
Right, if you're going to write a whole line, you're going to end up over here anyway at some point.
You move away from it. You see, you move with the chisel.
Think about it.
Going the other way, you're crossing.
Remember, there's no bias. So you can choose whatever direction you is more comfortable to begin with. And clearly, from the caveman to the Ugarits, it was just easier.
By the way, do people know that in Turkey in the 60s, Turkey used to be written like Arabic or Persian with those letters, right. And they switched in the 60s. Did they switch, in the 60s?
Well, that was when Kemal Atatürk modernized Turkey.
He modernized and he switched to English letters.
Yeah.
So that you could use a typewriter and a computer. Probably before computers. So you
way before.
Before computers, typewriters, maybe.
So they could type the newspapers, basically. That was and textbooks. And they switched in Turkey. So if you go to a mosque or the old-fashioned Turkish, they can still write in the old language, but most people write with A, B, C, D.
And are they writing Arabic A, B, C, D, or they're writing...
No, in English letters, but it's Turkish words.
Oh, it's Turkish.
They switched the alphabet from...
Turkish words with English letters?
So it's... They've transliterated their language in the 60s. Labeled.
Turkish is Arabic in Latin characters. It's not exactly...
It's actually
not Arabic. It's closer to... It's closer to Iranian, to Persian, than it is to Arabic.
And I'm just, what I'm always concerned about is when he was going to do it eventually too. If it's left on
not since it's been revised. I mean,
with modern Hebrew.
Modernized. I mean, it's in today's world. You wouldn't.
There's so much transliterated Hebrew in English writing. Nowadays, it's
yeah, but today it's so easy to put Hebrew into it. I don't see that ever happening.
It'll be parallel. It'll keep them both parallel for a while.
Now, not in the age of computers, where you can switch back and forth so interchangeable.
Just on a practical issue, the Jews were in the desert for 40 years. So for 40 years, they had to do them. When you were talking about the Etrog, it occurred to me, had to do the mitzvah of Etrog.
I don't think they had Lulavim and a Soygim in the desert, so they waited till they got to Eretz Yisrael for that one, I guess.
I was just going to ask kind of the logistics of getting Lulavim and Eretz Yisrael.
I don't think they had a Lulavim and a Soygim in Eretz Yisrael. In the desert.
The desert.
I don't know.
It's hard for me to say that, especially on tape.
I'm trying to remember who. Okay, I'll tell you after. We had a lecture. I'm trying to remember who it was, whether it was by Rabbi Boaz Ganut. About Lulav and Etrog, that he, with sources, he showed that it's the one korban that we still have is Lulav and Etrog. He connected. He showed that the way that Hashem in the Chumash relates to it, it's basically it's a korban in the Beit Hamikdash, and we just happen to take it out, to our Beit Knesset. But it's basically a korban.
Just in theory.
So maybe it didn't start until the Beit HaMikdash was.
Well, they had the Mishkan, they had Korbanot in the desert.
So why didn't they do
Mishkan?
This?
They certainly had in the desert. They just didn't have. I mean, Lulav and Etrog didn't take. Maybe they took them with them from. They had enough wood to build the Mishkan in the desert.
The logistics of getting one or two or three or four, I understand, but the logistics for the people to have got 100,000 is
first
another
quality,
story.
Second quality.
That's right. That's it. They sold them by category.
They wrap them in flax.
With and without piton.
That's right. No, they wrapped them in horsehair. They wrapped them in there. But there are parts of their existence in the desert that are very that are clearly remarkable, and there are midrashic sources, for example, to answer the question of how they obtained these materials. For example, the Mishkan itself was built with atzei shittim is cedar wood. Mm. Where do you get cedar wood in the Sinai Desert?
Yeah, I mean,
and you needed enough cedar wood to build a Mishkan. So there is a medrash that says that Yaakov brought it with him when he came down to Mitzrayim in anticipation of the time that they would need it. So maybe he brought down the Lulavim and Etrogim too. I don't know. But it's also possible that they took out of Egypt whatever they could get, which would include all the riches of Egypt and resources as well, such as wood and things like that.
That's maybe a possibility that they had it with them from that point of view.
Maybe the Midrash focuses on the wood as opposed to the silk and the gold. There's no Midrash about where they get the gold for the...
We know where they got the gold. The gold they got from Egypt.
They go. See, the problem is, when they plundered Egypt, they took the valuables, and wood isn't valuable enough to plunder. That's what the driving force of the Midrash. So then,
maybe,
on top of that, even with plundering Egypt, where do you get the wood? Wood's not valuable enough to, for the Egyptians to even have around, or to, in the quantities and to plunder. Nobody's going to plunder wood. That's what the problem comes with the wood,
maybe,
with the cheap stuff.
But maybe special stuff was made out of cedar wood that they used it.
Maybe the chariots were made out of cedar wood.
Well, they had
maybe some long pieces.
All those boxes that
carry clothing
and all other things that they used.
Okay, we will adjourn here. B'ezrat Hashem. Next week. What's next week? No, we should be out scheduled for next week. You can keep them, you can leave them here, whichever you wish.